The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Moshe Brisky now presents his lecture, Miracle on the 101 Freeway.
Just about a little less than a year ago, the evening of Thursday, September 1st, I was driving home on the 101 North Freeway. For those of you a little familiar with the exits, I was approaching Valley Circle. It was about 7:40 p.m. I noticed that the traffic was bottling up ahead, which is a normal occurrence on the 101. Looking back, that was the last thing I'm able to recall about that block of time. Until some time later, when I heard the voice of a paramedic. Well, I found out later it was named John Tucker. And he's calling out to me from amidst this fog of what felt like a very intense dream. So whatever I've been able to piece together about what happened between these periods of time is based solely on in the information provided to me later by the paramedic, by other firefighters that were on the scene, by other eyewitnesses from the police report. But from my recollection, I remember a voice disturbing me. That's the way I looked at it, of why is this person bothering me? His written accounts were that five different occasions he tried to bring me out of my state of unconsciousness. And although I became conscious long enough to say my name that he was asking for, I slipped right back in. From my perspective, this man was bothering me. I was in a very deep sleep and I was very comfortable. As I came to my complete stop in traffic, my car was struck from behind with tremendous impact. There was an SUV driving at full speed. Didn't see the traffic jams starting ahead, and just continued at 65 miles per hour going into what was my car, a parked car, in bumper-to-bumper traffic. The impact left my car, if you saw the pictures last night, looking more like a crushed sardine can than a car. It also caused my car to spin around a few times, and in the process, my car struck another vehicle. To this day, some of the ensuing details remain a mystery to all involved. For example, how long was I in the car before being taken out? And who took me out? How did I ever get out of that car? Was I ejected from the vehicle from the force of the impact? Did I, in a state of unconsciousness, find a way out of the car and collapse? Or did some stranger stop their car, take me out, and disappear from the scene and never identify themselves as the one who took me out? John Tucker and his team found me on the freeway ground some 10 feet from my car. And to date, no one has yet to step forward to say, I was the one that took you out. Since I kept dipping in and out of consciousness, I don't recall much of the conversation with John Tucker on the freeway. I do know that at some point he asked me if there was someone he could call. According to his notes, he said that I responded that he can call my wife, Mati. And then he asked for her phone number. And here's the strange thing, because if you asked me her phone number right now, I would just know what button to push on the cell phone. But John Tucker got her phone number out of me somehow in that semi-conscious state. I vaguely recall being lifted, shifted, moved about from one place to another. As I later learned, I was transported first by ambulance to the Lost Hill Police Station, which is about 3 miles away. And from there, a helicopter was waiting to take me to the UCLA Medical Center on account that that hospital has an elaborate trauma center. Now, I do have far more lucid recollections of the helicopter ride. I remember feeling very much at peace, very calm, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually at peace. That I remember. No panic, no fear. Maybe I was in a state of shock, I don't know, but I just remember lying there and just saying, whatever it is, it'll be okay. There was a sense of serenity as to what was happening. I really didn't know what had happened. There was one, the attendant in the helicopter had to keep very close to me so that he can hear if I was trying to speak. I did ask him, what am I doing here? He said, you were in an accident. I asked what day it was, where I was, where did this accident take place? If anyone was in the car, was it my fault? He answered each question, assured me that it was not my fault. I asked if the other party was injured as well. But I did not know the severity of the accident. I had no visual recollection of anything. I just remembered this very calm serenity feel, despite the noise. I remember speaking to God. I remember speaking to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And I remember speaking to my father. I'm not going to tell you that I heard answers, but I will tell you that I clearly remember having conversations, talking to them. All surprisingly calm. Well, once the helicopter landed on the roof of the UCLA emergency room, things started to get hazy again. I remember there being lots of activity, lots of chatter around me, lots of scans and x-rays, and then lots of doctors and nurses checking every part of me. I remember overhearing certain words being said above me as if I wasn't there, but they were just talking to each other. So I heard the words brain hemorrhage, I heard broken shoulder, I heard broken collarbone, and then I heard one doctor say the word, she said, deformity to the hip. I didn't like that word. So I asked from my state of unconsciousness, what deformity are we talking about? And they all laughed. And they said, that's just a word we use here. It means there's injuries to the hip. There were bruises to the face, bruises to the elbow, and bleeding from the head. Now, at some point in the middle of this foggy night, my wife and children started appearing. Now, understand, they were in worse condition than I was, because I was in this total state of calm. But for them, it's a different story. My wife was working at the mikveh that night. Thursday night is her night that she takes care of the mikveh that we have. And her phone continues to ring and ring with a number she doesn't recognize. She's doing her job at the mikveh. But when she sees this person is not stopping to call, she realizes she needs to pick up. And it's Mr. John Tucker, who says, I'm a paramedic, and your husband was involved in a car accident, and he's being airlifted to UCLA Medical Center, and you should get over there. So she calls for my two daughters tells them what's going on and that she didn't want to drive herself, so they joined her. And they're heading now from Agoura Hills to the UCLA Medical Center. You take the 101 to get there, the 101 to the 405. It's now about 8 o'clock at night. There's a lot of traffic on the 101, but at 8 o'clock at night, it should be easy sailing. But as they get to the city of Calabasas, it's backed up bumper to bumper traffic. You can't get through. It's just a parking lot. And they're trying to understand why at 8 o'clock at night is there so much traffic, especially when they needed to get in a rush to the hospital. And it's only as they approach the Valley Circle exit that they see that there was an accident on the other side of the freeway, still not putting two and two together. Because Monty never asked John Tucker where this accident took place. And as they pass the scene of the accident, I believe it was one of my daughters that take a look and say, could that be Abba's car? She has John Tucker's number in her phone, so she calls back John Tucker and says, what exit did this accident happen? And when he says the words Valley Circle, and they're at Valley Circle seeing all the sirens, all the flashing lights on the other side, that's when they realize this isn't good. So for that drive for them from the scene of the accident to the hospital was far worse than anything that I've been through. At some point, it began to set in that God had done something special here. That realization would become all the more profound and crystallized in the days and weeks and months to follow, as the full scope of what had occurred was revealed to me. Many of you saw the pictures of the vehicle last night, or perhaps you saw it online before. When my daughter Rachel went the next day to the tow yard to the car to retrieve to see if she could find my cell phone and any other belongings that were in the car, the foreman said, and how are you related to the deceased? And she said that she is his daughter, but that her father is very much alive. He was shocked. He said, that's not possible. I've seen many cars come into this yard looking like that over my years. There are no survivors of an accident of that magnitude. And the same sentiment was echoed by John Tucker, by the other firefighters, by the police on the scene. They thought they were coming when they saw the car to pick up a body. So as you can well imagine, I am humbled, I am overwhelmed, and I'm beyond thankful to God Almighty to be able to be standing before you, doing my thing. As for my condition, I did suffer a brain bleed and a concussion that night. And thankfully, by morning, I was told that the bleeding of the brain had subsided. I suffered from terrible bouts of vertigo. Anyone here ever have vertigo? It's not pleasant. I have a cure for vertigo, and it does work. Don't laugh. Lay's potato chips. It's the only thing that works. I kid you not, they had every therapist in the world coming into my room, turning my head this way, that way, every possible thing, nothing helped. For 3 days, I suffered from severe vertigo. Someone gave me this tip and said, try Lay's potato chips. I said, bring it on. I don't know, it's something that they put in the Lay's potato chips that does it, so. I suffered a fractured scapula, which has healed. My collarbone was broken in multiple places, and significant hip injuries, internal hip injuries. I underwent 5 hours of surgery to repair the hip and the collarbone, and which continue through physical therapy to go through the process of complete healing. So I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude, Hakaras Hatov, and appreciation to all those, the firefighters, the paramedics, the helicopter crew, the doctors, the nurses, the surgeons, the doctors in my community that took over, the nurses in my community that took over, and so many throughout the world that were sending me their tefillahs and their prayers and their best wishes. It meant so much to myself and to my family. Hodu Hashem ki tov ki lo'olam chasto, how fortunate and how grateful we are for all the tremendous blessings that God shows us. What came to mind most strikingly in the days and weeks after is this powerful prayer. And again, this was right before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur time. We say the Unesana Tokif. And you can't spell it out any more bluntly. Barosh Hashanah Yukasevun of Yom Tzom Kippur Yechaseimon. On Rosh Hashanah it is inscribed, and on the fast day of Yom Kippur it is sealed. Mi Yichya Umi Yamos. Who shall live and who shall die? Mi Bekitso Mi Lo Bekitso. Who shall live out his allotted time and who shall depart before his time? Now the cold, harsh reality is that there were many people who recited that prayer last year and they did so for the last time in their lives. They're no longer in this world. So what was I inscribed for the year before? What was sealed on the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur prior? Was it something different than what actually occurred? Was there an 11th hour reprieve, this last minute reprieve? And if there was a reprieve, what brought it about? Who knows? But it sure gets you thinking. It gets you thinking about the uncertainty of life from one minute to the next. Because you never know from one day to the next, you just never know. People always ask the question, what are the human's biggest fears? What do we as human beings fear the most? And of course, illness and death are up there on the list. But you may be surprised to know that the top three things when people are asked what they fear the most are helplessness, loneliness, and insignificance. The fear of being insignificant is a huge thing. Now, why is that? I mean, sometimes it's really hard not to laugh at the absurdity of the human condition. Every day, we scurry around, all full of ourselves and our aspirations, seemingly oblivious to the fact that relative to the vast universe and the sweep of history, we are this tiny speck at the tip of a leaf. Even in the happy event that we get to leave a small mark on this world, it's just a matter of time before, like a pebble in the ocean, you know, you toss it and you see the little waves, we just disappear. A few rings in the water and that's it. Gone. Oblivion. And yet there is this nagging part of us that for some reason needs to feel significant. We need to know that our lives matter. That people think about us, that our days count, that unlike cows that are munching on the grass in the pasture, we need to know that our lives have meaning and have purpose. It's an essential human need. Well, 3 years ago, the world lost a true giant in Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi of Great Britain. A world-acclaimed speaker, he has lectured thousands of times all over the world, meets thousands of people all the time, wrote many, many books. So someone once asked Rabbi Sacks, in all of your thousands of engagements, what question are you asked more than any other? You take question and answer sessions after every lecture. What's number one? What's the number one question that people ask you in these encounters? Is it perhaps on the Torah perspective on science? Is it Judaism in the modern era? Is it issues of Jewish law? Is it comparative religion? Rabbi Sacks thinks for a moment and he smiles and he says, the question I'm asked on the circuit more than any other is this. Rabbi Sacks, do you remember me? There's an expectation that I remember them because we met some time before. More than any other question, that's what people want to know. And how profound is that? We all have many needs, none more pressing than the need that somebody sees us, that someone recognizes us, that someone remembers us. We all need to know that we matter, that we're significant. This rabbi shared this emotional experience he recently had when visiting a very old cemetery. So he was out there to officiate at a funeral of a congregant, and while there, he stopped to read some of the tombstones that are there. And among those, he's reading a tombstone of someone who's been buried for over 100 years. And he reads the tombstone of this one woman who lived a full life, but had now had been gone for over a century. And he's standing there in front of her grave, and he asks himself the simple question: does anyone alive today remember her? She's been gone for 100 years. Does anyone remember her? Does anyone remember any of her friends, any of her contemporaries? The answer is probably not. Many of us, but not all of us, grew up with living grandparents, and we remember them well. But how many of us have met or have lasting memories of our great-grandparents? How many of us know the names of our great-great-grandparents? Chances are not too many of us. So that's it. 3 or 4 generations and you're forgotten, even by your own family. These people lived full lives. They got married. They had children. They had grandchildren. They were part of a community. But who remembers them? Most of the time, no one. As Udinasana Tokef prayer goes on to say, a passing shadow, a fleeting dream. Life is like a passing shadow, a fleeting dream. It's not as if we haven't heard that before. We all grew up singing this little cute song, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. So yes, it's sugar-coated with merry and rowboats and gentle streams, but the conclusion is life is but a dream. And how long do dreams last? So in 90 years from now, in 100 years from now, who's going to remember us? We sitting here. And if the answer is no one, then what does it really all matter? Okay, now you're wondering, where's he going with this? I came here to be a little inspired, to be moved, and he's depressing me. We'll turn it around, don't worry. We have another very powerful prayer, and we recite this 4 times a year. It's the Yizkor Memorial Prayer. And while we each recite our personal Yizkor, mentioning the names of our departed loved ones, we all begin the Yizkor declaration the same way. Yizkor Elokim, may God remember. Nishmas Abba, remember my father, my mother. Yizkor Elokim, may God remember. Note, we don't say, may I remember them. We don't say, may we remember them. Yizkor Elokim, God remember them. And I want you to think about those words. Let God remember. The point being that even when everyone else forgets, Yizkor Elokim, God remembers. God remembers everyone, and he remembers everything. God remembers what Adam and Eve did in the Garden of Eden, what Abraham did at Mount Moriah, what Moses did at the burning bush, what Jonah did in the belly of a whale, what the Lubavitcher Rebbe did from his office in Crown Heights with the same exact recall and clarity that he remembers what you did this morning. Yizkor Elokim. God remembers. So rather than be depressed, we should all be uplifted and invigorated, because to God, everything counts. Lives, words, deeds, actions, they all count. They all make a difference. Everything matters. Maimonides tells us that a person should imagine at all times that all of the deeds of his entire life are evenly balanced between good and bad. There's 2 sides of a scale in life, and now imagine the scale is perfectly even, and your next deed will tip the scale to 1 side of the scale. Then Maimonides says, I want you to imagine that the entire world is on a scale, perfectly balanced. All of the world's existence, all of the deeds of the world of humanity till this point, and it's exactly even. And your next deed will tip the scale of the world. Now, I don't know if there was ever a time in any of our lives that our deeds were perfectly even. Nor do I think there was ever a time in history where the morality of the world was perfectly balanced. So what's Maimonides' point? I think Maimonides is simply providing us with a very important mental aid, a visual aid, so that you go through life knowing that you make a difference, that your deed matters, that nobody is insignificant. The Rambam is not talking in terms of quantitative balance as much as qualitative balance, that you can do something seemingly minor, small, that can have enormous and momentous effect on people's lives, on the world, for both the foreseeable and unforeseeable future. When Clint Pulver was a little boy around 8 or 9 years old, he could never sit still in class, and he would constantly be tapping his hands the entire time. It drove classmates crazy. It drove the teacher crazy. Go trying to teach when someone's just doing this the whole day. His fellow students would complain. The teachers would send him to the principal's office for being so disruptive, and this would go on and on and on. One day, a new teacher was assigned to Clint's class. His name was Jensen, Mr. Jensen. And after putting up with Clint's shenanigans for about a week, Mr. Jensen asked Clint if he would stay after class. Now, he's been used to this. He's assuming, I know, I'm in trouble because I've been banging on my desk the whole time, and that's what the teacher's going to be telling me about. And instead, Mr. Jensen said, Clint, I asked you to stay because I have a question for you. Do you ever think of playing the drums? And he then pulled out a pair of drumsticks that he brought with him. And he said, you're not a problem. You're a drummer. You just need to keep drumming away. And sure enough, Clint Pulver took to the drums like a fish to water. He had a new outlet for his restlessness. Fast forward today, Clint Pulver is, in fact, a world-class drummer. He's also an author and a motivational speaker. People show up by the hundreds, sometimes by the thousands, for his talks, and he inspires someone, so many, for better lives. And at almost every presentation, he gives credit to a grade school teacher named Mr. Jensen. For it was that moment in Jensen's class that changed his life. As Clint puts it, somebody saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. One simple, creative, out-of-the-box action by a thoughtful and sensitive teacher changed the course of a human being and all those that he inspires today. Rabbi Yitzchak Vachnin and his wife, Rebbetzin Masuda Vachnin, both of whom were born and raised in Morocco, were the spiritual leaders of a Sephardic community in Maalot, Israel. During the early years of their 65-year marriage, Rav Yitzchak served as the principal of a girls' seminary, and his wife helped along in the seminary. One day they learned that one of their students, her name was Mazal, was engaged to a wonderful boy named Hanan, and the entire school celebrated the occasion. Now, among Sephardic Jews, or those that took the debate, there's differences in tradition. There's a widely followed custom that the Shabbat after the wedding is called the Shabbat Chatan V'Kala. It's a big celebration. Everyone comes together for the celebration of the first Shabbat of the newly married couple. Unfortunately, this young couple, Hanan, was from an orphan. So he was from an impoverished family. And Mazal's family also were not better off. And so it was decided, we had the money to make a wedding, but we do not have the money for the Shabbat Chatan V'Kala. When Rebbetzin Vachnin heard about this, she was very upset. How could a newlywed couple not have a memorable Shabbos to celebrate their union? And so she let them know, there will be a Shabbat Chatan, there will be the celebration. I'm handling it. I'm hosting it. tell your family to come, it will happen. And she went about making her phone calls, having people volunteer, baking, cooking, raising money, getting a hall together. She did it all so that the Chatan and Kala would have this beautiful Shabbat experience like all other Chatan and Kalas have in their community. No expense was spared. Throughout the entire Shabbos, Mazel was beyond overwhelmed. This was so beautiful that all this was being done for them. And this, they were so close to not having this at all. And look at the beauty of people and the chesed and the kindness, especially of the Rebbetzin. And she resolved at that point in her life that one day she was going to pay this forward. She was going to do this for someone else that didn't have the money to sponsor this. Decades passed. Hanan Mazal built a large, beautiful family of their own. All in time, they kept in touch with the Rebbetzin, never forgetting her kindness. And as for paying it forward, well, Mazal Sabag did much more than that. It didn't just become a one-time project. It became a lifelong project. She let it be known in all Sephardic communities, if you ever have a poor couple that can't support and can't sponsor the Shabbat Chatan V'Kala, you let me know. I will raise the funds. I will host it. I will do it. And she became known in the Sephardic community of doing this dozens and dozens of times, all because some Rebbetzin did this for her. When Rebbetzin Vachanan passed away, Mazel, now an older woman herself, came to the Shiva to comfort the family. And this is what she said to them. Over the years, I have had the schus, the privilege, to cook hundreds of meals for the Shabbat Chatan of poor and orphan newlyweds who had nowhere else to turn. I want you to imagine this scene when the Rebbetzin went up to heaven. They would have shown her all these magnificent events that she had orchestrated, to which she would say, "It's gotta be a mistake. I only did this once. You're showing me pictures of places and things. I have no idea who and where and what. I had nothing to do with that. 67 years ago, I organized one for a couple." And at that point, the truth would have been revealed, that that one Shabbat led to all of these, saving so many young couples from sadness and embarrassment. One mitzvah, one thoughtful deed, and there's no telling where it all leads. You see, my friends, I think we need to tweak our understanding of what being relevant means, of what it means to be significant. We don't have to perform some grand gesture on the world stage to matter. Even the smallest, most discreet of acts become the stuff of legends. Speaking of Israeli weddings, there was this one bright summer day in Jerusalem. A young bride is walking with her mother towards her chuppah, and she's holding this small, colorful umbrella over their heads. Now, it wasn't raining, so everyone there is thinking it must be some tradition in some other group. Maybe the Sephardim thought it belonged to the Ashkenazi custom. The Ashkenazim thought it belonged to the Sephardim. Europeans thought it was an Israeli custom. There's got to be some reason the Kala is walking down holding an umbrella when it's not raining. Maybe the sun is too bright. The truth is, there is no such tradition written of a Kala walking to her chuppah holding a small, colorful umbrella. And during the wedding, the Kala asked to speak. And she said, "Many of you are wondering, why did I walk with an umbrella to my chuppah?" Some 13 years earlier, it was a cold and rainy day in Brooklyn. More than just raining, it was a heavy downpour. This little girl is holding a tiny, colorful umbrella, and she's standing patiently in front of 770 Eastern Parkway, Chabad's world headquarters. She's waiting, she's hoping to catch a glimpse of the Lubavitcher Rebbe as he arrives for prayers. This is something we kids did growing up in Crown Heights. If we were around at the time that the Rebbe's car would pull up, we would love to be there, because perhaps we would get a glimpse of the Rebbe. The Rebbe would smile to us. It would mean the world to us. So this kid is waiting out there, and it's a pouring, raining day, so she's got her umbrella. She's waiting all by herself because there's no other customers that day, and soon enough, the Rebbe's car pulls up. The Rebbe leaps from the back door, comes out. The Rebbe didn't have an umbrella with him and was hurrying to the door when he notices this little girl waiting to greet him. So the Rebbe stops in the rain to smile at the little girl and looks at her warmly. And as he turned to continue towards the synagogue, this innocent child offers the Rebbe to share her umbrella. Sweet and cute. The Rebbe walks over and bends under this little girl's umbrella and walked all the way to the door of 770 under this little girl's umbrella as the girl held the umbrella over the Rebbe's head. When they came to the building, the Rebbe held the door open for the little girl, smiled broadly, and said, "Thank you for sharing." It was underneath that same umbrella, which witnessed such a sensitive act, small in size, but huge in heart and symbolism, that this bride, she says, the Rebbe's former umbrella carrier, chose to begin the new chapter of my life. That he cared so much about the sensitivity of a child, walking just those few feet, it changed my entire life. And so when I'm walking to my chuppah, I wanted to remember that moment. You see, often rain and gloominess washes away our spirit. We're often in a hurry to find refuge and safety for ourselves that we are oblivious to those waiting to be greeted and seen by us. We often pass small moments that can transform the lives of others due to many pressing issues in our own lives. But to the Rebbe, no act of kindness was too small, no moment was too trivial, and no person was too insignificant. Earlier in the retreat, the first days, Rabbi Mordechai Farkash was here, and he shared the following story with me a while back. He met a Jew from Jerusalem who owned a business. The business fell on hard times, and he found himself in debt to many people, including some pretty bad actors who made his life miserable. With nonstop threats and harassment, his life became a living hell. And after years of suffering, he decided he can't take it anymore. He's going to do the unthinkable. He's going to bring an end to this misery once and for all. His plan was, after leaving the house that day and making believe he was going to work, he would head to a bridge on the outskirts of Jerusalem. One can easily go off that bridge, hurtle down into a cliff, into the abyss, and in a matter of seconds, it would all be over. So he's leaving his house, and he says his final goodbye to his wife. She doesn't know what his thoughts are that day. He's heading to his car, and she calls him out by name and says, "Wait, wait. You're going to work? Do me a favor. I prepared a package for our son. Could you please drop this package off at yeshiva on your way to work?" The teenage son was a student at the Chebner Yeshiva, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, in Jerusalem. He slept in the dorm during the week, so apparently the boy needed some items, told his mother. His mother put together a package. This is a problem because his plan was to go off on the bridge and the trip and the yeshiva was on the other side of town. But all right, you know, the last thing I do in my life is a favor for my son. It's not the end of the world, so to speak. I can kill myself on the way back. I'll live another couple of hours. It's not the end of the world. He takes the bag and he gets into his car. He goes to the yeshiva. He walks into the building. He enters the hallway. And just then, one of the mashpias, the spiritual teachers and guidance counselors of the yeshiva, is exiting the study hall. So he says to the mashpia, "Would you possibly know where such and such student is? Can you ask him to come out? I have a package from him, from his mother." The mashpia says, "He's in the middle of learning right now, so I don't think it's a good idea to disturb him. Leave it with me, and I'll give it to him later." So he says, "Okay, fine." Now, at first, the mashpia thought that perhaps this man was a taxi driver, a delivery boy. He said, "I have a package from his mother." So he says, are you related to this boy?" He says, "I'm his father." "You're his father? Wow, tell me something. What schus, what merit do you have that God would give you such a boy? Such a gem. Your son is a diamond, a mensch with a heart of gold, such a phenomenal head on his shoulders, a precious soul, so lovable, such a source of light and sensitivity. We love every moment that he's in this yeshiva. It's a privilege to have him here. So I want to know, what did you do to have such a son?" The man goes back to his car and thinks to himself, I'm gonna kill myself. I'm gonna commit suicide because I'm in debt a few million shekels. I have a phenomenal son. I'm gonna take his father away from him forever, turn him into an orphan by choice. For what? Because of money? I have a wonderful wife. I have a family. Am I crazy? And he knocks some sense into himself. He went to work. He came home. He ended up moving out of Israel. He moved to the United States. He got a good career. Over time, he paid off all of his debt. And he's now connected to the Chabad community in Washington State. And he shared this story with Rabbi Farkash. Think one compliment. You don't know what those compliments do. Are we so stingy on our words? What does it really take to say a few kind words to someone? To give a warm compliment, to know how much a teacher may mean to your child, to tell that teacher that, or the opposite way, for a teacher to tell a parent something good about their student. And to tell any child something good about themselves. Words that come from the heart enter the heart, and we can impact a person's life of those around us. We can affect the course of generations. One simple act, one simple deed. Yizkor Elokim. God remembers all of our deeds. So what is it that I said earlier? Even in the event that we leave some small mark on the world, it is just a matter of time before, like a pebble in the ocean, we disappear. That's just not true. Those sort of pebbles in the ocean do not disappear. They never disappear. They continue to create ripples that turn into huge waves of merit and goodness that wash across the sands of time. God sees it all. God knows it all. God keeps track of it all. He knows every deed is interwoven with the other, and the other with the other. He knows as clear as day who triggered what, who impacted what, who initiated what. It's all there and remains there forever. Yizkor Elokim, God remembers. So we worry about relevance. We worry about significance. We worry about continuity. My friends, the solution lies in having a relationship with God Almighty. Because in His eyes, you always count. You're always significant. You always matter to Him and will never be forgotten by Him. Because God is infinite, which is why connecting ourselves to Him, we connect ourselves to that which is infinite, to eternity. I'm sure many of you in this room have gotten involved in many different projects and programs for the physical or spiritual benefit of others in your community, including people you never met, and chances are people you never will. You've either gotten personally involved in making these programs happen, or you supported them financially, or both. This much I can tell you. You have no idea of the endless good you have affected as a result of that. Those ripples continue to impact your community. And from there, its veins and its streams and its tributaries spread forth and impact the entire world in countless ways that we cannot begin to fathom. Because Yizkor Elokim, God never forgets. God doesn't lose track. There's a rabbi in Dallas, Texas, who tells how he's sitting in his office one day, and a fellow comes in and hands him a check for $10,000. Now, it's a nice day if you're a rabbi. Someone just walks in unsolicited and gives you $10,000. And he asks, and what's this? And the man says, I just got back from Jerusalem. This is not a man he ever met before. And I went to the wall. I went to the Kotel, where I saw this Hasidic Jew dressed in the garb. I watched how he prayed at the wall. He prayed with such fervor, with such devotion. I was so inspired. It made such an impression on me. And I was thinking to myself, I'm never going to be like that man. I'm never going to pray like that man. The least I can do is facilitate that sort of devotion to others that do. So here's a donation. Have me in mind when you pray. Now, for years thereafter, this man continued to come once a year to this rabbi, giving him a check for $10,000 because of that guy praying at the Kotel. When this man passed away at the man's funeral, the rabbi told the story of how we first met and this $10,000 annual gift because of this incident at the Kotel. The man's mother, who had survived him, hears this for the first time and says, I would like to continue that tradition now in the memory of my son for the rest of my life. Now, that Hasidic Jerusalemite who prayed at the Kotel that day, he should live and be well for 120 years. But one day he's going to make it to the heavenly world. He's going to face the heavenly court, and God will line up all of his credits and his debits. And then God will say, and this is for the Jews of Dallas. And he will say, Dallas? Who is Dallas? What's Dallas? Where's Dallas? And God will tell him, one day you prayed at the Kotel, and there was a man from Dallas, Texas, standing next to you, and he was inspired. And he went into a day school, and he gave a check for $10,000, and he continued to do that every single year. And then his mother continued to do that. And hundreds of children were educated because of the way you prayed one day. Maimonides wasn't exaggerating. One deed really makes all the difference. I was thinking a lot about this whole subject during the days, the weeks, and the months since the accident. I found myself struggling with what I found out is called survivor's guilt. Survivor's guilt is a particular guilt that develops in people who have survived a life-threatening situation. And although I didn't know the clinical term for it initially, I certainly found myself backed by that sort of guilt. Knowing as I do many people who were involved in similar incidents who didn't come out alive. Knowing parents who lost young children in fatal car accidents. I found myself desperately searching for answers. I made phone calls to other survivors of tragedies. I made phone calls to parents who lost children or loved ones in accidents. I spoke to many rabbis and mentors. And while I can't say that I found anyone definitively comforting or the answer, at one point I was reminded that my dear father of blessed memory addressed this very question during a video interview we were able to get him to sit down and do back in the year 2008. And in that revealing interview, he recounted for the first time in his life many of the experiences of his youth and the story of his survival during the Holocaust, much of which we heard then literally for the first time in our lives. And towards the end of this interview, he says in Yiddish that what he experienced was not just nisim, but he called them nisei nisim, miracles upon miracles. It defied all logic and natural phenomena, which then led, he said, to a very sobering reflection on his part. And I guess you could call it his struggle with survivor's guilt. Being the only member of his large family to survive, he posed a rhetorical question, why did I survive? I know that until Mashiach comes, there's no way for mortal man to understand why they perished. But at least let me try to understand why I survived. Why did God foil the need to keep me in this world rather than send me along with my parents, brother, and sisters to the other one? He went on to say that it can't be as a reward for anything I've done previously because I was just a kid of 16, 17 years of age. Eventually, he said, I concluded that it was al shem ha'osid. It was for the future. God was investing in me because he foresaw what would come down the line. He foresaw my children and my grandchildren and felt that the world would need them to be part of this world for the decades to come after the Holocaust. It was because of the family that I would yet create, the souls that I would bring into this world, and the lives that they would yet touch. It was God's investment in me in the future. So that was the answer that my father made peace with. That was his take. Now, whether or not that was God's motivation, who's to say? But I've decided to apply at least that message, that perspective, in some way to my own situation. I was granted a reprieve. I'm living in what I call bonus time. Not so much due to any personal merits, but more so due to the merits of the work as an emissary, as a shliach of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, trying to inspire others to do good, to take on a mitzvah, to lead a more wholesome life, to study more, to share more, to care more. And perhaps all of those good deeds done by the community over the years created angels. And those angels were released on September 1st at the Valley Circle exit on the 101 freeway. And perhaps in addition, I was granted this reprieve, this bonus, al shem ha'asid, as God's investment for the future. In other words, I got a lot of more work to do here in this world. It's been an inspiring 40 years since I went out west. Thousands upon thousands of lives have been touched and positively impacted forever, not because of me, but because of the mission, because of the outreach work, because of the supporters, because of the congregants, because of the students, and because of my colleagues, the shluchim and the shluchos I've had the privilege to work together with. But from this point on, I'm heading into bonus time. My takeaway from this experience is not that it's time for me to slow down, but quite the opposite. It has to be full speed ahead. No pun intended, I wasn't the one driving fast. As much as has been accomplished over the past four decades, there's more to be done. And God is clearly expecting bigger and better things. You know, it's an amazing gift that God gives us, this ability to transform material and physical resources into goodness and spirituality, to enable the legacies of our very transient and fragile lives to live on for all eternity, because Yizkor Elokim, because God remembers, and God doesn't remain in debt. One way or another, one day or another, he pays us back. I've always known this to be true, but now I know it with even greater clarity and certainty than ever before.
Thank you very much.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.